It's really wonderful to introduce John. I met him a couple of years ago, and I'm so thankful that he's in this world, that his intelligence and his youth and his energy and his way of doing good in the world is open for all of us to have with us. A few things about John. He's a constitutional attorney in Boston. In 2003, John was the lead counsel representing soldiers, parents of soldiers, and members of Congress to run a constitutional challenge against the Bush presidency for going to war absent congressional declaration. That was a great case in Boston. He's also the author of Warrior King, and it's a wonderful book about the illegality of going to war in 2003. He's co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org. I hope you all know about the Downing Street memo. John was one of the first to expose that. He's the founder of the National Voting Rights Institute, protecting our voting and clean elections across the country. In 2006, he took leave, and as we probably all in this room know, he ran for Massachusetts Secretary of State. And I know that if we had gotten clean elections funds, and if William Galvin had agreed to debate John, this man would be our Secretary of State. Thank you. This is John Boniface.
And I first want to say how honored I am to be here with Cindy and to see her again. She is a true heroine for our country and for our world, and we thank her for standing up so much. I'm honored to see Dan, to meet Dan tonight. I think what he's doing in Vermont has a major rippling effect for the nation, and I know you're going to hear from him tonight. But I also, before I make my remarks, do want to highlight Progressive Democrats of America again. I am on the national board of this organization. I'm proud to be on it with Cindy and many others. And, you know, I once heard Dolores Huerta, the famous United Farm Workers organizer, speak at law school I was attending, and she said, there are three things you have to do to create change. Number one, organize. Number two, organize. Number three, organize. And Progressive Democrats of America embodies this notion that we must get out and organize for change. And clearly this audience tonight is an example of that. To get the word out for a Saturday night event here in Greenfield, it's a fantastic showing. I thank you all for being here, but I salute Progressive Democrats of America for the organizing it's doing day in and day out to stand up against this war. I'm going to start just by bringing us back to the eve of this war, when soldiers, parents of soldiers, and members of Congress, led by John Conyers Jr. and Dennis Kucinich, stood up and sued the president in federal court in Boston, challenging him for lacking the constitutional authority to launch a first strike invasion of Iraq absent a congressional declaration of war or equivalent action. Now, how do we get to that point? Well, I think it's critical when we talk about the war in Iraq today that we remember that it, at its inception, began as an illegal and unconstitutional war. Now, to focus on that point, I'd like us to imagine for the moment that Congress were to pass a resolution which stated the following: the president is authorized to levy an income tax on the people of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to pay for subsidies to U.S. oil companies. Now, no amount of legal wrangling would make that resolution constitutional. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution makes clear that Congress, and only Congress, has the power to levy income taxes on the American people, and it cannot transfer that power to the President of the United States. Now let us turn to reality. In October 2002, the United States Congress passed a resolution which stated the following: the President is authorized to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to, one, defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, and two, enforce all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq. As he determines to be necessary and appropriate, Mr. President, you decide. You decide, based on whatever evidence or whatever lies you have, whether or not to take this nation into war. We as a Congress will delegate that power, that awesome power, over to you. Well, the framers of the Constitution intended that this would never be so, that no one individual would have the power in this country to make that decision of taking the nation into war, that we, the people, would maintain and hold that power through our elected representatives in Congress. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, emerged from that collective will. Congress shall have the power to declare war. No other language in the Constitution is as simple and as clear. Thomas Jefferson talked about his desire to create, quote, an effectual check to the dog of war. George Mason said that he was, quote, for clogging rather than facilitating war. James Wilson, speaking at Pennsylvania's ratifying convention, stated, "This system will not hurry us into war. It is calculated to guard against it. It will not be in the power of a single man or a single body of men to involve us in such distress, for the important power of declaring war is vested in the legislature at large." Several years after the adoption of the Constitution, James Madison would write these words: "In no part of the Constitution is more wisdom to be found than in the clause which confides the question of war or peace to the legislature and not to the executive department. Beside the objection to such a mixture of heterogeneous powers, the trust and the temptation would be too great for any one man." Now let us travel two centuries later to that hurried debate on the floor of the United States Congress and the United States and U.S. Senate and U.S. House in October 2002. The President sent this resolution over to the Congress, recognizing that there was going to be a national election in November for all House seats up for re-election, one-third of the Senate. And in a hurried debate, the Congress voted on this resolution. Senator Byrd, the leading opponent of this in the United States Senate, talked about it being unconstitutional from its inception, called it a rag, said this resolution had no basis under the War Powers Clause, and demanded that the Senate not vote for it. But of course, as we know, both houses, the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, passed this resolution, and the Congress delegated its exclusive power to declare war over to the President. And so there remained one final step, one institution that could stand in the way of this President's illegal march into war, and that was the case we brought up against the President before the federal judiciary. Now, the judiciary did not do its duty either and did not stand in the way of this President's illegal march to war. It stayed on the sidelines. And so this is really a story, when we talk about the war today, of all three branches of government, the United States Congress, the U.S. federal judiciary, and the President of the United States, the executive branch, all three branches of government failing us and trampling on the Constitution. And we know today what happens when we give one individual this awesome, awesome power. And we knew it so early on after the invasion began. Many of us, of course, protested this before the war. But for any doubters out there as to whether or not there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, it became very clear early on that that too was false. On Sunday, May 11th, 2003, 2 months after the invasion began, the Washington Post ran a headline on its front page: "Frustrated U.S. arms team to leave Iraq. Task force unable to find any weapons." The newspaper reported that the 75th Exploitation Task Force of the United States Army, the group directing all known U.S. search efforts for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, was, quote, "winding down operations without finding proof that President Saddam Hussein kept clandestine stocks of outlawed arms." The article quoted Army Colonel Richard McPhee, a leader of the task force, as saying, "My unit has not found chemical weapons. That's a fact. And I'm 47 years old, having a birthday in one of Saddam Hussein's palaces on a lake in the middle of Baghdad. It's surreal. The whole thing is surreal." Referring to the weapons of mass destruction, McPhee said, "Do I know where they are? I wish I did. But we will find them. Or not. I don't know. I'm being honest here." 2 weeks prior to the Washington Post article, the British newspaper The Independent reported that, quote, "intelligence agencies on both sides of the Atlantic were furious that briefings they gave political leaders were distorted in the rush to war with Iraq." The newspaper quoted a high-level UK source who said they ignored intelligence assessments which said Iraq was not a threat. Now let us travel 2 years later, May 1st, 2005. The London Sunday Times reveals these official government minutes from the British government coming to the light of day for the first time, the Downing Street minutes. Official government minutes taken at a meeting in July 2002 at 10 Downing Street, Prime Minister's residence, at which Sir Richard Dearlove, the highest-ranking intelligence officer in Britain, was reporting back to the Prime Minister and to his top national security officials about meetings that he had just had in Washington in the summer of 2002 with high government officials about the president's plan to invade Iraq. And as we know, those Downing Street minutes were really the smoking gun, if there ever needed to be one, demonstrating that the president, long before he had gone back to Congress with his hurried resolution, long before he had gone to the United Nations for a so-called effort of a UN Security Council resolution, that the president had decided as of the summer of 2002 that he would be invading Iraq to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, as Sir Richard Dearlove reports, by launching a war which would be, quote, "justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD, weapons of mass destruction." But the minutes go on to reveal that Dearlove states in the meeting, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. And now we get to the question of impeachment. You know, the framers also knew when they drafted the Constitution that there would be the need to provide for a provision for the people to take a president out of office if he has abused the public trust, if he has trampled on the Constitution. And James Madison, speaking at Virginia's ratifying convention, stated a president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton, writing for the Federalist, stated that impeachment is for the misconduct of public men from the abuse or violation of some public trust. And James Iredell, who would later become a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, stated at North Carolina's ratifying convention that if the president were not to give full information to the United States Senate, and if the Senate were to go on and take actions that were harmful in the area of foreign policy, injurious to the country, then that ought to be considered an impeachable offense. Barbara Jordan, former member of Congress, on July 25, 1974, the late Barbara Jordan spoke to her colleagues on the House Judiciary Committee of the constitutional basis for impeachment during the Watergate proceedings. "The powers relating to impeachment," she said, "are an essential check in the hands of this body, the legislature, against and upon the encroachment of the executive. Impeachment," she added, "is chiefly designed for the president and his high ministers to somehow be called into account. It is designed to bridle the executive if he engages in excesses. It is designed as a method of national inquest into the conduct of public men. The framers confined in the Congress the power, if need be, to remove the president in order to strike a delicate balance between a president swollen with power and grown tyrannical and preservation of the independence of the executive." This president has shown time and time again that he is unwilling to obey the mandates of this Constitution. He has taken this nation into an illegal war, seizing on monarchical powers that were never present in the Constitution. He has lied to the United States Congress and to the nation about the basis for that war. He has authorized and allowed torture by members of the United States military and extradition to developing countries where such torture is used. He has authorized and ordered domestic spying on Americans on U.S. soil in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It is time to demand that there be articles of impeachment introduced into the United States Congress to charge this president with committing impeachable offenses. Now, I know what the naysayers have to say about this. I've heard it already. You don't have the votes. You don't have the will within the United States Congress. This is going to appear political. This is going to hurt our chances in 2008. We've got to move on. We need to end this war, and we can't do it by focusing on this. You know, we need to cut off the funding for this war. We need to demand an end to this war. And we need to demand impeachment as well. We can do both. Now, I will just close with the words of Dr. King. As we know, you know, a lot of people celebrate Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. Every January 15th, on his birthday, we celebrate that speech. And it's a powerful, powerful speech for the nation. But he gave another speech, as we know, in April of 1967 in Riverside Church in New York, in which he spoke out for the first time, a year before he was to be assassinated, against the war in Vietnam. And he received an enormous amount of criticism from within the civil rights movement, from his allies in Congress, and from the media. After that speech. And after that speech, Dr. King recites, "One day a newsman came to me and said, 'Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to stop now opposing the war and move more in line with the administration's policy?' As I understand it, it has hurt the budget of your organization, and people who once respected you have lost respect for you. Don't you feel that you've really got to change your position? Dr. King says, I looked at him, and I had to say, sir, I'm sorry. You don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I've not taken a sort of Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a molder of consensus. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it expedient? And then expedience comes along and asks the question, is it politic? Vanity, Dr. King said, asks the question, is it popular? Conscience, he said, asks the question, is it right? Let us do what is right. Let us stand up for our conscience. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. I think that's the big question for all of us. It's time for us to do what's right.